Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to take a little different approach to some subjects. We're going to have a conversation with a remarkable mind. We're going to look at Big Pharma and the medical establishment as organized crime. That's not me saying this. That is my guest, Dr. Peter Gotsche. That is Gotsche. He is a specialist in internal medicine and a co-founder of the Cochrane Collaboration, which was started in 1993. He also established the Nordic Cochrane Center at the University of Copenhagen, where he is now its chief physician and researcher and a professor of clinical research, design, and analysis. He's become an international critic of mammography screening and has written extensively on it being scientifically unjustified and has been published in peer-reviewed literature. In Europe, he is a leading advocate for clinical data transparency within the private and government establishment and is a voice demanding priority for patient welfare over commercial drug interest. In addition to his book, Exposing the Lies Behind Mammography Screening, his most recent release is Deadly Medicine and Organized Crime, How Big Pharma Has Corrupted Healthcare. One of the most harsh indictments against the drug industry for selling lies about drugs rather than medically proven treatments and cures. He will be up first. Then in the second part of our program, I'm going to play a very unique interview. This is actually a part of a documentary that I have in post-production on Poverty, Inc. And as you will see when this series comes out, it's a series, not just one documentary. Wall Street financial institutions were responsible for a substantial amount of the meltdown, but they were also responsible for the bubbles, working with the Federal Reserve and regulators. And I want to take a more in-depth look in Wall Street to show you who these people who were making millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, what kind of people they are. I consider them sociopathic. And yet we refuse to be honest in our evaluation. We'll only look at how successful they are. And unless they're in the middle of some major scandal, we never question how they make their money, these major corporations. How do you pay tens of billions of dollars in fines, and yet you're right back to being profitable? How's that possible? So there's an individual that is behind one of the Wall Street firms was. His name was Jordan Belfort, and I filmed him, not knowing at the time that he would be the subject of a major motion picture, which opens in a couple of weeks, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and directed by Martin Scorsese. It is a blistering indictment of the entire culture of Wall Street. You have not seen anything like this ever. I have never seen anything like it. I've never heard anything like it. This man is so brutally honest about himself and everyone else that he came in contact with. It is filmed. You can watch this. It's been edited. It's about 24 minutes. And if you go to progressiveradionetwork.com and when we go to play it, you can listen and watch. Or if you're just listening over our sister stations, you can just listen to it. So that's our program today. Let's say hello to my first guest, who's on the line now, Dr. Peter Gotsche. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Before we get into the specifics of your concerns, I want to share what I consider some associated issues. And I'm not going through all of them, just the title and a few words about each one. And then we'll tie that into our topic. This is from Dwight Lundell, medical doctor. Quote, "We physicians, with all of our training, knowledge, and authority, often acquire rather large ego that tends to make it difficult to admit we are wrong. So here it is. I freely admit to being wrong. As a heart surgeon with 25 years experience, having performed over 5,000 open heart surgeries, today is my day to right the wrong with medical and scientific fact. I trained for many years with other prominent physicians labeled opinion makers. Bombarded with scientific literature, continually attending educational seminars, we opinion makers insisted heart disease resulted from the simple fact of elevated blood cholesterol. The only accepted therapy was prescribing medications to lower cholesterol and a diet that severely restricted fat intake. The latter, of course, was insisted would lower cholesterol and heart disease. Deviations from these recommendations were considered heresy and would quite possibly result in malpractice. These recommendations are no longer scientifically or morally defensible. The discovery a few years ago that inflammation in the artery wall is the real cause of heart disease is slowly leading to a paradigm shift in how heart disease and other chronic ailments will be treated. The long-established dietary recommendations have created epidemics of obesity and diabetes, the consequences of which dwarf any historical plague in terms of mortality, human suffering, and dire economic consequences. Despite the fact that 25% of the population takes expensive statin medications, and despite the fact that we have reduced the fat content of our diets, more Americans will die this year of heart disease than ever before. Statistics from the American Heart Association show 75 million Americans currently suffer from heart disease, 20 million have diabetes, 57 have million have prediabetes. These disorders are affecting younger and younger people in greater and greater numbers. Simply stated, without inflammation being present in the body, there is no way that cholesterol would accumulate in the wall of the blood vessel and cause heart disease and strokes. Without inflammation, cholesterol would move freely through the body as nature intended it. It's inflammation that causes cholesterol to become trapped. And then it goes on from there. Unusual? Yes, extremely unusual. But one more to add to that, because we take a very careful look at those people within medicine and science who've chosen to stand up and go against the consensus by taking a look at something that is just accepted. Right now it is vaccines. We have spent years of in-depth research trying to ask just a basic question. Is there scientific evidence supporting the safety and efficacy of vaccines? Everyone assumes, yes, of course so. Our research does not provide that assurance. To the contrary, this is the latest this morning from Dr. Tony Bark, BARK, medical doctor. Those vaccinated with the pertussis vaccine are spreading disease. Quote, the recent news articles to hit the mainstream media in the past week finally states what public health officials and epidemiologists have known for some time. Those vaccinated against pertussis are carrying and spreading the bacteria and are responsible for most of the outbreaks. This news raises the question, should we hold those vaccinated with the pertussis vaccine legally liable for outbreaks? And if you look up scholarly articles about previous outbreaks of measles, you'll find academic papers on an entity termed paradox of measles, a paradox because those vaccinated are the ones contracting the disease, whilst the unvaccinated in many communities without outbreaks are unscathed. In addition, the rise in shingles over the past decade or so is due to the chickenpox vaccine. This link is not denied in academic literature and was even predicted by mathematical biologists and epidemiologists and was confirmed by another study funded by the CDC. And hence, if vaccinated children and adults are capable of spreading disease, shall we hold them and their parents legally liable for outbreaks? Shall we mandate unvaccination as a requirement for public school? Since we cannot unvaccinate, shall vaccinated children be kicked out of public school? While the above statement seems absurd, they are equivalent arguments bioethicist Art Kaplan has and continues to make. Who is Art Kaplan? He believes that parents of unvaccinated children should be held legally liable for outbreaks of disease. He's no regular academic bioethicist. He is a bioethicist who has made an enormous amount of money writing pro-pharmaceutical articles. If you read about Art Kaplan and his direct financial conflicts of interest, you also read Art believes these financial conflicts can be managed while producing unbiased work. He and his previous institution of employment, the University of Pennsylvania Department of Bioethicists, received mega fees from major pharmaceutical companies and vaccine makers, and the Department of Vaccine Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania was massively funded by big vaccine producers. And then it goes on from there. Now, I bring these two to your attention to start our discussion. Because for us, this is normal. this audience, which is worldwide, is always being shown that because an official organization or a group of physicians or scientists say something is so, doesn't necessarily mean that it is. And there's a great deal of bias, especially when it comes to the pharmaceutical interest. Let us begin from there. And if you would please take us on a look at what is the mission of the Cochrane Collaboration and its special mandate of scientific integrity in order to critique the clinical data, pharmaceutical drugs, and government health and regulatory policies and professional medical associations, medical journals.
Are you asking me?
Yes,
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, we try to get as close to the truth as possible. So you may call us a kind of research detectives because there is so much bias and even sometimes fraud in clinical research. So it's necessary to be very, very careful when you try to find out what the benefits and harms are of our drugs. So that's what we try to do.
Then that would lead into an obvious follow-up, but then based upon the methodologies and the research protocols derived from the Cochrane projects, take us into the rationale you outline for regarding Big Pharma and our medical healthcare establishment as synonymous with organized crime. The forum is yours.
Yes, I found out last summer that the business model of drug companies seems to be organized crime. I did a simple search in Google, search on fraud combined with the 10 biggest drug companies. And within the last 5 to 6 years, there have been major crimes. The world's biggest company, Pfizer, has been found guilty of organized crime and a conspiracy. And most often, the companies settle so that they don't come to the verdict stage. But that doesn't make the crimes any less serious. And they actually do the same.
Could you give us some examples, please?
Yes. According to U.S. law, organized crime is the act of doing certain things repeatedly. And these things can be bribery, other forms of corruption, fraud, embezzlement, obstruction of justice, and so on. And when I found this out last summer, I decided that although there were many books about the drug industry, I had just had enough and felt that I needed to write my own book to try to wake the general public up to the fact that there is a lot of crime out there, and it has huge consequences in terms of theft of public money, because the drug are not so good that we think they are, and also in terms of very many lives lost because we don't know the harms of our drugs. So should I expand a little on that?
Yes, yeah. We'd like for you to take us through your
yes.
investigations.
Yeah. There are several studies. There is one from United States, one from Norway, and a report from European Commission, and there is other evidence that tells us the same story, which was very surprising for me when I found out that our prescription drugs are the third leading cause of death after heart disease and cancer. It's a major killer. Now, you might think that it's only to be expected that drugs sometimes kill people because we use them in very ill cancer patients, so it's a calculated risk that some patients will die because of the treatment and not because of their cancer. But that's not the case. We could not have so many deaths if it could be explained so easily. What happens is that half of all these deaths occur while the patient do exactly what they are told by their doctors. So there are no errors made, and the other half die because of errors. They take too much, or the doctors are not aware that the patient takes several drugs that interact in a harmful way and that they should not have had. And then, of course, you would be interested in which drugs are the major killers, and I have also looked into that. One of the real big killers is the anti-arthritis drugs, the painkillers. Vioxx was taken off the market by Merck in 2004, but there are many, many other drugs, and they are very dangerous. We have always known that people can die because of bleeding stomach ulcers, which kill around 20,000 people in the United States every year. But many of these drugs also kill people by blood clots in the heart, myocardial infarction. And it's not only Vioxx, it's a lot of other drugs, including drugs that are still on the market, like Celebrex and Diclofenac, ibuprofen, and so on. And the tragedy in all this is that many doctors regard these drugs as harmless because of the drug industry's fraudulent marketing. So they prescribe them for virtually everything. You can have a tennis elbow, you can have pain in your back, and you are prescribed these drugs, even though paracetamol might give a similar effect and it won't kill you. So there is a lot to be said about how doctors prescribe these drugs. So I think the public should be aware that in most cases, when you have pain, you actually don't need anything because it gets better with time. And if you need something, try paracetamol instead, because it won't give you a heart attack or a bleeding stomach also. So this was one very important group of drugs. Another important group is psychiatric drugs. They are used to an unbelievable extent. At one time, antipsychotics was the most sold type of drugs in the States, and antidepressants came in number fourth. And it's hard for me to believe that the Americans should be so seriously mentally disturbed that they need these drugs to this extent. This is also the force of drug marketing. And psychiatrists receive more money from the drug manufacturers than any other specialty in America. And those who receive most drugs are also those who use antipsychotics the most to children, our most vulnerable citizens. And for example, antipsychotic drugs are very, very dangerous. I have estimated that one of the most popular ones, Zyprexa from Eli Lilly, has killed around 200,000 people. So these drugs should be used much, much less than they are being used now. They are dangerous. And what people don't know is that even antidepressants are dangerous. Many elderly people get them because they have lost their loved one and feel lonely. And these drugs are very dangerous in the elderly. If you give them a drug, an antidepressant drug, for a year, you will kill approximately 1 out of 30 in just 1 year. And this is, for example, because these drugs affect balance, like many drugs do. And when elderly people fall, they might break their hip. And 1/4 of those who break their hip, they actually die from it. So people don't know how dangerous these drugs are. Not even our doctors know how dangerous they are. So this is also a reason why I wrote my book.
I appreciate those insights. I have a little different perspective, and I'd like you to give us your learned opinion on this. You were mentioning today that the psychiatric drugs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors amongst them, they're prescribed so frequently that up to 25% of all adult women are taking them. But the biggest market, and you mentioned Prozac or Zyprexa, the biggest market for psychiatric medication today are in children. And when I began to see this happening about 15 years ago, I did a documentary on it called The Drugging of Our Children. And I began to interview school teachers all across the country. And I asked, give us an idea of what you see in the classroom. Now, this is typical. I interviewed over 100 teachers in different schools. This was typical. If a student has not been nourished properly, it has nothing in this case to do with money, because this can be from a very wealthy family. If they're staying up late at night, if they're on their computer, if they're not getting a good night's sleep, And then they wake up in the morning, generally having trouble getting out of bed. They'll have something quick, and almost always it's a caffeine-loaded beverage, either coffee or soda, something sugar-sweet to boost their blood sugar level up. And then when they're sitting in class, they're bored. Now they have a mind that's what brain that's wired. They have a caffeine addiction. They have a sugar addiction. More often than not, the classroom is not as exciting or interesting as or multidimensional as the world outside or their internet, and so they don't take a lot of time to pay attention. Or they may be very bright, and this class may be not be being taught at a level they like. These are the feedback I'm getting. As a result, they tried to work with the individual students. Today, more often than not, if you make any one of about 15 different wrong moves, if you fidget, if you look out the window, if you blurt out answers, if you go to the bathroom too many times, you're going to end up in the psychologist's office. You're going to get a diagnosis of ADD or ADHD. You're going to be put on Ritalin. 10 million American children are on that. When I was going to school, none. This can also lead to suicide and taking these drugs. Suicide is the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys in the United States. No one should be dying between 10 and 14, unless it's an accident, and they're killing themselves. And yet the American Medical Association, the world medical community, the very doctors that you are one of, but not you, because you've had the courage to stand forward, as this other surgeon did, they're not even looking at this. They're accepting that we now have a new class of diseases that are brain chemical imbalances, and they're calling them social anxiety disease, and they're calling them a parental defiance disorder, or math disorder. Now they have over 270 of these. So virtually any behavior today can be classified as mental illness and then put on a drug, and then you have to take the drug. Why hasn't your profession stood up and said, this is wrong? This is not about disease or helping children or making diagnosis. This is about marketing for profit. Would you answer that, please, sir?
I agree completely. I consider modern psychiatry the biggest disaster area in healthcare. Some American friends told me that in American summer camps, one quarter of the children are medicated for mental problems. This is so tragic, and it's awful. And as you say, people look too little into the causes of why people behave like they do. And the way you make diagnosis in psychiatry is not very scientific. And I also write in my book that seven successful colleagues and myself, we went to the American website called Psych Central, and we tested ourselves for three different things, ADHD, depression, and mania, and not a single one of us escaped a diagnosis. So this tells you something about how insane all this has become. And then the drugs that are being used in our children, I suspect that they might perhaps give permanent brain damage, because we know that antipsychotics give permanent brain damage. And there are some studies that indicate that even other psychiatric drugs can give permanent brain damage. But the drug industry and the psychiatrist have not studied this. So we don't know what will happen to our children when they grow up. So there is a lot to be said about that. And one more thing I would like to say is that children who get ADHD drugs like Ritalin or who get antidepressant drugs, roughly 10% of these children, they develop a much worse disease, which is bipolar disorder, which is being treated with these very dangerous antipsychotic drugs. And furthermore, it's difficult for people to stop many of these drugs. The psychiatrist and the drug industry have denied fiercely for many years that the newer antidepressant drugs can lead to abstinence symptoms, And this is wrong. About half of the patients have difficulty stopping the drugs, even though they taper them slowly over many months. And some people never succeed stopping the drugs, so they are on them for life. And the doctors sometimes add insult to injury, because when they then try to stop the drugs, they tell the patients that's because the disease has come back and you still need the drug. No, it's not. It's usually abstinence symptoms, like if an alcoholic has no more alcohol. And we should remember that these drugs are similar to amphetamine. So in a way, they are narcotics on prescription, and they should be used as little as possible and in as short periods as possible. But unfortunately, this is not what happens. It is absolutely terrible. So I am going to devote the coming years of my life to try to wake up the psychiatrists to the epidemic of chronic patients they have created with their drugs. We have had many more chronic patients and not fewer. So if these drugs were really so good as the drug industry wants us to believe, we should have far fewer patients on disability pension. That's not the case. Children, I mean, people below 18 years of age, the number on disability pension has exploded with a factor of 35 in the period where we started to use these modern antidepressant drugs.
I appreciate your insights. Thank you. I'm going to give you one final question. It'll be with several different points, and answer it in whatever way you choose. If you or I were to break the law, if we were to have been found to have been negligent, let's say negligent killing someone in a car accident, that would be a moniker we would have for the rest of our lives. I hired two attorneys who worked for over a year doing nothing but seeing how many lawsuits to Wall Street firms and banks and pharmaceutical companies have brought against them. How many do they settle? How many is there evidence showing guilt? And what happens? When I was told the number, I said, "Are you sure?" They said, "Yes, we use LexisNexis." It was into the hundreds of thousands of lawsuits. And many of these companies have been sued thousands of times. And they simply build into the cost of doing business the settlements. Therefore, with Vioxx, 60,000 died, 125,000 had heart attacks and strokes, though many of them could have died, but there was no additional follow-up. And they paid about a $5 billion fine. The value of the stock went up, the head of the company got a raise, and I said in a state hearing under oath at the time, I said, only in America could you kill 60,000 people and get a raise. I found it just almost felonious. It didn't make any sense to me. You should have had some remorse as a profession, especially the rheumatologists. They had been on the wrong track. The very people denied there was any relationship between diet and arthritis or inflammation from diet and arthritis were responsible for that. There was no sense of irony whatsoever. And it's also true that 10 million American women are taking synthetic hormone replacement therapy each year, and the side effects are heart attack, stroke, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer, and dementia at a 13% minimal adverse rate, and it's probably higher. That means that we are sacrificing up to 1.5 million women each year. And again, this has been going on for over 30 years. At what point is this medical genocide? And yet, instead of looking honestly, diligently at the fact that we can turn hot flashes off, we can remineralize the bone, the only two reasons they're using this, and do it safely without these, we continue doing the ads, promotions. And then on top of that, the poor physician today frequently is not aware of how indoctrinated they are, because many of the medical schools are funded substantially by private foundations that are themselves funded by pharmaceutical companies. Chairs of pharmacology are common, and therefore the physician is not as rounded as they should be in understanding psychoneuroimmunology, environmental impact, etc., stress in relationship to disease, and so everything is then a prescription. So I'm very concerned about the current medical model being not only limited, but deadly and needing a change. Your final thoughts, please.
Yes, I agree with that. And the number of deaths is just unbelievable. And I also believe that those at the top in drug companies, they are those who are ultimately responsible, and they should be put behind bars. I think that is the only thing that might deter them from continuing committing their crimes in the future, because, as you said, these fines are just regarded as a marketing cost. So the whole system is out of control. So that's why I call them criminals, and that's why we must put them behind bars.
Good for you for saying that. Man, is that rare for a physician, a scientist, a professor, someone who has an outstanding reputation to come forward and tell the truth. Others know the truth. You're certainly not alone. Many do. But just understand that you're going to be now up against something that you never expected, that you were never taught. The Center for Corporate Policy in Washington, D.C. just released a paper today called Spooky Business, Corporate Espionage Against Nonprofit Organizations. And what they showed here was that people who criticize any industry, including the medical industrial complex, are going to be targeted by black op groups, and they're going to infiltrate, and they have, and they give examples. So when things start to go wrong and you wonder why, and when they're not willing to debate you openly and honestly, and you say, why not? And when your reputation gets tarnished, as others have, you'll know that this is the other part, this is the hidden hand that they use. So you have the courage to stand up and call Big Pharma and the medical establishment organized crime. I commend you for doing that, Dr. Peter Gersha. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to go now to a presentation that normally you wouldn't see for about a year from now until the film comes out. But because my documentary, the main film that this man's in, is coming out in a couple weeks, I wanted you to have a chance to listen or watch. You can watch by going to progressiveradionetwork.com. This tells you the truth about what the real culture on Wall Street is like. Listen up to what this man has to say, because he was a part of it, Jordan Belfort.
What type of person goes to work on Wall Street? I think you'd have to say these are people that are mostly in search of lots of money. And when they start making money, that's when the problems start. It's endless pursuit of what they believe is going to fill them up and make them feel good, which is endless supplies of money, but it never does. So they feel this hollowness. So they go out and buy things to try to fill them up. They buy Ferraris. They buy $2,000 suits. They go out for super expensive dinners. They rent houses in the Hamptons. Once they have that, then they take a whoo. I still feel empty. What do I do now? So now they look for the next step. They got to make more money and get even, you know, a bigger house in the Hamptons and start flying in private jets. Instant gratification. And you get caught up in this pressure on Wall Street of trying to achieve the next quarterly number, the next monthly gross minimum. So people start making decisions that are just based on making money now. It looked really great when all these big firms on Wall Street were trading these derivatives and these, you know, issuing these credit default swaps, taking in nothing but money and being perceived as the ultimate masters of the universe while times were good. And meanwhile, everyone was just looking the other way, sacrificing any ethical or moral responsibility in the pursuit of short-term profits. And it unwinds. You see these ethical decisions, this lack of ethics in these decisions, destroy everything and cause a meltdown of biblical proportions. When you sacrifice ethics, you want to backdate a trade or, you know, take a contract from something and book it to the quarter before to up your numbers. Yeah, it looks good for a while, and in the end, it unravels.
What started in America last year has now spread to every part of the world.
We're down 9% today. The Zetra DAX over in Frankfurt is down by 9%. The Paris market down by 9%. Austria.
The problem is that in ethics, not just on Wall Street, in any business out there, whether it be in the insurance business, like you saw with AIG, or in GM, where they're, you know, making mistakes, you know, and then bankrupting that company, what happens is a lot of decisions that are ethical sometimes aren't great for short-term profits. And I guess the question is why, what makes, you know, what, like, listen, look at me. I went down to Wall Street. I come from a great family. My mother was one of the most well-respected attorneys in New York State, the oldest woman to pass the bar. My brother's one of the top healthcare attorneys in the United States, a partner at a big firm. okay? My dad never broke the law in his life, and his CPA, and then there's me, who ended up going to jail for securities fraud and money laundering. What happened to me, you know, that when I went down to Wall Street, I lost my path? Well, part of it, okay, was bad luck. The people that I met some people that were crooks. They showed me the dark side of Wall Street, the underbelly, and I went with that direction. That's not an excuse, though. That's just sort of a, you know, what you'd call a trigger, okay, catalyst, okay? What happened with me was deep down was my desire for instant gratification. I wanted money now, and there's no better place to get that on Wall Street. No one goes down to Wall Street and loses their soul on day one. I'm sure people like John Thane, who spent $1.2 million on his office furniture while Merrill Lynch was bleeding more red ink than a hemophiliac with a gunshot wound. I don't think he started off that way. He's probably a good guy, very legitimate, but he got completely numb to what is normal in the rest of society. There's a certain sense of entitlement, a sense of power, where you just think that you're above it all. Okay, I'm John Thane, I'm the head of Merrill Lynch, and what the hell's wrong with me spending $1.2 million? But the truth is, John Thane didn't build Merrill Lynch, and the guys that took private jets to Washington, D.C. didn't build General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. They're high-paid stewards of other people's work. They came in after the fact, stood on the shoulders of geniuses, and then milked it for all they were worth. That's the problem, is the people that are running these corporations and these brokerage firms, they didn't build them. They were built by the Carnegies and the Schwabs and all the people way back in the day. I mean, whatever names they're, the J.P. Morgans. You can keep going on and on with that. But these people came in after. Their own money's not at risk. There's no pride of ownership. They have nothing at stake. So that, you know, moral responsibility, you know, it falls by the wayside. There are two types of people on Wall Street now, operators right now. And I think you need to separate out a guy like Bernie Madoff from the rest of the people. There's a class of people like Bernie Madoff who are out and out thieves. Bernie Madoff did not run a legitimate game. He was just simply taking people's money and stealing it. Okay, people would send him money. They thought they were investing in the stock market. Instead, he was just sending bogus confirmations out and using a basic Ponzi scheme where he was paying off new investors with old investors' money. And as long as he could keep raising more and more money, he could show them what they thought were good returns while sucking off enough money to live an extravagantly, you know, an extravagant lifestyle. Please be them. The only way to avoid those people, okay, is to basically do your due diligence. Okay, and you know, be smart. Don't just give your money to the first person that calls you or anyone that calls you on the phone. Check out people's reputations. And Bernie, you know, listen, in Bernie's case, he had a great reputation. He was a regulator, for Christ's sake. He was the head of NASDAQ for a while, which is a joke. But the telltale signs were there. It was too good to be true. The returns were above what they should have been. If anything on Wall Street seems too good to be true, it is. There's nothing given out for free on Wall Street, except for the people that run the firms. They run the casinos. You are just a gambler in their world. And when you go to the casinos, right, you look at these beautiful buildings. They weren't built by winners. They're built by losers. Okay, you can make money on Wall Street as an investor. If you have a good broker and you're playing for the long term and you're in legitimate stuff, yes, Wall Street is a great place to invest your money. So I don't think that, you know, people overall, you know, when this is a crisis right now, when this is all said and done, I don't believe that the answer is for people to lose faith in the financial system and to never invest with stockbrokers anymore or money managers or hedge funds, whatever people want to do. I think there is a really legitimate element out there on Wall Street that deserves the trust of America and the world for that matter. But the thing with, you know, someone like a Madoff, it's just a fraud. Okay, the rest of Wall Street, the problem is that sliver in the firms that's illegitimate that brings the rest of it down. So Bernie Madoff was a crook. What's happening on Wall Street now, which has melted down the economy, has nothing to do with Bernie Madoff. It's a far more dangerous breed of person than Bernie Madoff that's causing these problems. There are always going to be Bernie Madoffs around. There's always going to be people that break that are going to just go out there and thieves. They're common thieves, okay? And what I did was not like Bernie Madoff. I actually ran a legitimate firm. And here's why I did was so terrible and why it's even worse than what Bernie did and what people did at Merrill Lynch at Lehman Brothers and at AIG, why it's worse even, is because they had legitimate businesses. And they, within that business, there was a germ of it. There was some percentage of this business was completely fraudulent. And that's enough on Wall Street to bring down the entire system. In other words, you can't be half pregnant with ethics on Wall Street. Either you're going to operate ethically, you're going to run a legitimate firm, or you're not. You can't say, well, 95%, listen, let me backtrack for a second. If 2 years ago, someone said to you, is Merrill Lynch your legitimate firm? Oh, yeah, well, of course, Merrill Lynch is totally legitimate. They're Merrill Lynch. They manage money. They're in business for 100 years, so on and so forth, right? Well, That's true. And 95, maybe 97% of Merrill Lynch was legitimate. However, there was 3% of Merrill Lynch, this sort of growth engine managed by a few people, not all of Merrill Lynch, that would wanted nothing but to make money at all expenses. They didn't care. 10 years ago, the same division, you know, in a different form, bankrupted Orange County. They bankrupted Orange County. That's, people forgot about that, okay, in the 90s. And that kind of slid under the rug because it was just Orange County. It was 8 million people, no big deal, right? It wasn't America, so it kind of slid under the rug. But what you have is this portion within Merrill Lynch where they're just doing insane things, where ethics is non-existent, where greed is everything, okay? And what that does is it poisons the entire company. That's what went wrong with a company like Merrill Lynch or Lehman Brothers. They were legitimate in other ways, but you know, Dick Fuld couldn't see past his own mastery of the universe and his own just want for, you know, he didn't want to make $100 million, he wanted to make $500 million for himself.
Lehman Brothers is in serious trouble.
Lehman Brothers stock has been plummeting along with confidence in its ability to survive.
I think at a certain point when you cross over to the dark side of the force, you just, like, nothing is taboo anymore. You know, you look at these guys like, you know, at Lehman Brothers, or how about Bear Stearns? When Bear Stearns was crashing and burning, what was Jimmy Cain doing? He was smoking pot and playing bridge with his friends. You know, how could he justify that? You know, but I don't think he got there overnight. If, like, the Jimmy Cain that probably went down to Wall Street early on, or the Jimmy Cain of 30 years before that, would have probably been there with his shirt sleeve rolled up on the trading desk doing anything he could, okay, to try to save things. You know, how did Dick Fuld do what he did? From Lehman Brothers, the same thing. Robert Rubin, look at this. Robert Rubin was the former Treasury Secretary, right? He goes, becomes Treasury Secretary. He lobbies to have the limits eased on derivatives, which allows firms to make, you know, buy these derivatives and leverage them up. He's instrumental in getting these derivatives approved to be traded on Wall Street in a very aggressive way. Okay, then what does he do? He's no longer Treasury Secretary. He's out of office. He goes down to Wall Street, gets on the board of Citibank, convinces them to plunge headfirst into these derivatives, the ones that he deregulated when he was Treasury Secretary, and he makes $500 million by most accounts, somewhere around $500 million, and he bankrupts what was once the largest bank in the world. He goes from being a politician, changing the law, then going back to Wall Street, you know, with his old cronies. He used to be Goldman Sachs. He goes from Goldman Sachs to the Treasury. Then he eases the laws, so everyone on Wall Street makes a fortune while he's Treasury Secretary. Then he goes back to Wall Street, takes over Citibank, goes on the board, and blows up Citibank and walks away, and he's not indicted yet. Does something seem wrong with that? There's something fundamentally wrong with that in my book. So let me go back to my story. I had a firm. When I was very young, I went down to Wall Street and I was a cold caller. I did really, really well. I was the top cold caller of my firm. I became the top stockbroker in my firm. I would say good luck or bad luck, but my first day as a stockbroker, the market crashed. It was 1987, October 17th, 1987, and the stock market crashed, and my firm, LF Rothschild, which was a great firm in business for many, many years, went out of business. 6 months, I was commuting down to Wall Street. It was costing me $100, $120 to get down there on the Long Island Railroad and the bus and the subway, and I was only getting paid $99 a week. So I was losing $30 a week to train to be a stockbroker, and I watched all these young kids making a fortune in the bull market of the 80s, and when it was my turn, the market crashed the first day, and I was out of a job. I picked up the newspaper looking for help, you know, help wanted. I was looking for anything but Wall Street. I would have sold plumbing supplies. It didn't matter. I just wanted to sell something. And I stumbled upon an ad for a brokerage firm in Long Island. I answered the ad, and it turned out to be selling penny stocks. I didn't even know what a penny stock was. I was trained in New York Stock Exchange stocks. To cut to the chase, I ended up going to this penny stock firm, becoming the largest, you know, the most successful broker at this firm. Well, these people were also at the penny stock firm were selling, you know, 20-cent stocks to mailmen and people that were teachers, people that really couldn't afford to invest in the market anyway. Ultimately, at that point in time is when I sacrificed my ethics, because what I saw, it was wrong. It wasn't, you know, I saw everyone was losing money. The clients were getting killed. But I was 24 and I was so broke at that time that I just desperate. I was getting evicted from my apartment and I needed to make money. And that's how the problem started. I decided to open up my own firm, and I came up with this little niche where I decided to try to sell, you know, $4 and $5 stocks to the richest people in America. No one had really tried that before in an organized way. And it worked unbelievably well. And what I did is I used a two-call system. At first, I would sell them Eastman Kodak, so they, you know, brand recognition. They knew Kodak. Once they opened up an account with my firm, the second trade was into a $5 stock. And, you know, the amount of money we were making was staggering. I went from, you know, from rags to making $50 million a year when I was 26, 27 years old. And I was just living this insane life. And, you know, it was basically this boardroom I had in Long Island, which was 1,000 kids all under the age of 25 years old. It became like the, you know, the sort of the amalgam of the seven deadly sins all wrapped up into one. Okay, it was Wall Street on Long Island. It was complete insanity. There was drugs going around the office like Pez out of a Pez dispenser. There was hookers in the basement turning tricks to service the needs and wants and desires of all the crazy stockbrokers. Within the four walls of the boardroom on Friday afternoons, we had midget tossing competitions, cracking champagne, people were getting their heads shaved. It became like the Roman circus. It just spiraled out of control and became a self-contained universe. It was disgusting, yet it happens. How does that happen to a guy like me from a good family? Step by step, incrementally. You know, you take one step over the line of morality and you take it back and then you do things right. And then all of a sudden you take another step over the line and before you know it, you're stepping so far over the line that it just seems okay. You know, it's like you put your toe in the bathtub, it's piping hot, and you pull it out. You put it back in again, it's not quite as hot. 5 minutes later, you're submerged under the bathtub and the water feels perfect. That was the story of my life. And, you know, I had some gifts that I was born with. I was born with the ability to stand before a crowd and speak. And I used that in an evil way to manipulate young stockbrokers. They would come to me and I would sell them a bill of goods and say, you know, this is what you're going to do. You got to sit this way, act this way, say this at this time and so on and so forth. And you got to buy the nicest car, eat the nicest restaurant, and greed is good. And it's about making money and money is a wonderful thing. And you can take care of your parents with money and it's your obligation. You owe it to this one and that one and blah, blah, blah. I go on and on day in and day out, twice a day for years straight, and it was sort of like this cult-like environment developed, and the kids loved it. Just everyone loved it, but deep down at the root of it was evil, okay? However, the business itself was legitimate. In other words, it was a regular broker recommending stocks and whatnot. They weren't, you know, scam stocks. They were legitimate stocks. However, at the root of it, there was 10% of my business that was completely illegal, and I was manipulating their wishes. And that was making a lot of money doing that. And that 10% destroyed everything else. What leads to that sort of decadent behavior? And I guess I would say, without getting too religious here, the devil's tempting. Okay, and he's always there. And you know, whether you're religious or not, just how you want to view the devil, all those things, you know, I would be lying. Even right now, listen, I'm sober now for 12 years. Okay, back in the day when I was doing all that, I was addicted to massive quantities of drugs. I was doing each day enough drugs to sedate a family of grizzly bears. Every single day. Quaaludes, cocaine, ecstasy, marijuana. The list goes on and on and on. You know, 10 different prescription drugs. Anyway, most of the people that work for me were also on drugs. So when people are using drugs, they tend to do wacky things. But even without those drugs, what happens is a lot of those things, listen, you tell a 22-year-old kid, here's the deal. You're going to come work for me, okay? I'm going to teach you to make $1 million a year despite the fact that you don't have a college degree. I'm going to show you the best suits to buy. I'm going to show you how to lease a Ferrari or buy one for Calgary. I'm going to give you all the connections. I'm going to have the best prostitutes, beautiful girls, mostly college girls, and struggling models who need more designer clothing. And then at nighttime, you're going to go into the city and drink Cristal champagne, and you're going to drive around in limousines and be the toast of the town and get into all the clubs and get the best seats. You're going to have the life. That's pretty tempting to any 20-year-old kid, any 20, 50-year-old man. It's tempting, okay? And you know what? Now, you know, I've had some pretty good runs later on after this whole thing happened, and I wrote a book, and it became a bestseller, The Wolf of Wall Street, and I sold the movie rights, and Leonardo DiCaprio is going to play me in a movie, you know, directed by Marty Scorsese, all this big stuff. People are like, oh, my God, you're the best writer. Like, you know what? I'm like, no. I'm nothing special. Like, you know, I lived a life. I told them, you know, you learn to, when people tell you all these great and wonderful things about you, no one's so great and wonderful, okay? And, you know, you're only as good as the last thing that you did. And I allowed for what corrupted me was all these accolades. And, you know, it's very intoxicating. And I, like most people that go down to Wall Street in pursuit of money, when I got the money, the only thing it filled in my, the only thing that happened to the hole I had was it grew larger. And with each million I made, the hole grew larger. So I tried to do more obscene things to fill that hole. To buy, if I only buy a bigger house, then I'll buy a big mansion with 20 servants. Let me, you know what? It's not, I'm going to buy a yacht. 160 feet. I go buy the yacht. you know what, I really want to have a helicopter on the yacht, but it would be really great if I could put a plane on the yacht too. Let me go put the yacht back in the yard, extend it 10 feet, so I can then put a seaplane on it, so I can take the seaplane and go diving on my seaplane and go shoot lobsters with a spear in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. You start, and then I'll feel good about myself. But then I did that, and that didn't make, you know, do the difference. You know, I was like, oh, well, you know, this yacht, I don't know, it's really not that good. So I went and drove it into a hurricane in a storm, and I sunk the yacht and almost died with my family because I was, you know, just, you, this insanity goes on and on and on, and there's just no end to it. It is really easy to lose your way, okay? It's a lot of good people, it's not just the bad people that lose their way. Good people lose their way too. But what I tell them is, remember, look at my life, because frankly, I had it all. I was on the top of Wall Street, you know, flying around in private jets and doing the whole thing with mansions and servants. And not only did I lose all my money, but I ended up in an ice cold jail cell. Okay. And I was on Con Air flying above America in shackles. Okay. Sometimes scared to go into the shower because Bubba might come and get you. And you know what I was doing when I was in those places? I was closing my eyes and envisioning the faces of my two children, who back then were 11 and 9, and I, you know, I'd have tears in my eyes, how I let them down, what kind of example, the embarrassment their father must have caused them. And, you know, I said, when you're out there in the world, remember, tomorrow comes. Remember me in that jail cell, and think, you really want to backdate the order of the contract? You really want to artificially inflate the number? Next time you're wondering whether or not you should make the extra $2 million, think of me. Is it possible to redeem yourself? The answer is yes, okay? You could look at examples like Michael Milken, okay, and say, how did a guy like Michael Milken redeem himself? And I guess, you know, it's easy to say, well, Michael Milken was still, you know, unlike me, Michael Milken was left with a lot of money. So he had $500 million to spread around to charities and whatnot to essentially buy his way back into the good graces of society. However, that being said, Michael Milken also does a lot of great things and deserves to be in the good graces of society because he happens to be a great man, okay? And he's an example of a guy who 98% of what he did was legitimate and maybe 2% was illegitimate. And if you think every person on Wall Street back in the day wasn't doing exactly what Michael Milken was doing, you're wrong. There was going on hook, line, and sinker all over Wall Street. And as we see now, it went all to the highest levels of power, to the biggest firms. They were all engaged in the same shenanigans. Michael Milken's problem was he just became too big, too fast, stepped on too many toes. And what he did was he basically unlocked the power of the average American. I'm talking a guy who wasn't in the old boy WASP network. He gave basically Jews the key to the executive washroom. He allowed people like Nelson Peltz and Ronald Perlman and all these corporate, Carl Icahn, he created these guys, gave them war chests of cash to go in and raid America's oldest and most venerable corporations, and he just sent shockwaves through the channels of power of the United States. And they went after him. Was he doing things wrong? Yes, he was doing some things wrong. Any worse than anyone else? No. Does it make his right? No. Okay, did he deserve to go to jail? Yeah, maybe so. I guess they all did. Okay, but it is what it is. At the end of the day, Michael Milken's a good man. He does great things. He made a mistake. He served his time, and that's that. So you can redeem yourself. I'm trying. It's not easy. And I guess also, if you would have said, you know, 15 years ago, did Michael Milken redeem himself? Maybe not. No, it takes time. He's been out there a lot longer than I have. He's doing a lot of good things. So I think we all can over time. And, you know, some people will never forgive me. There's certain people that clearly need to be brought to justice. The people that really did things that were egregious and, you know, that were the chief culprits of this whole thing.
You've been listening to Jordan Belfort, the real life character, and a person who now, because he rose to the heights and fell into the pit from the dark side of his being, is telling you his story. It'll be interesting to see the film, but at least we're having a chance to hear about the culture of Wall Street. I'm Gary Noll. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen on tomorrow's program, Commentaries, The War on Democracy. Will Colorado be the next state to vote on GMO labeling? And if so, what can we do about it? Also, Monsanto's behind the journal's retraction of the GMO rat cancer link. I'll give you the facts on that. 700,000 people on the United States watch list. How'd they get on there? No, they're not telling us. Once you're on there, you can't get off. Noam Chomsky and the Willful Ignorance of 9/11. Shame on Noam Chomsky. You'll hear why, and many of the other, if not most of the other, college intellectuals on this issue tomorrow. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you very much for listening.
Day after day, I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light.